this point in the series, we arrive at a sequence of three lectures which are about myths. I won't begin by attempting to define myths, because it's actually easier to define them at the end, if indeed define them at all, rather than try to define them at the beginning. But I have given already a slight indication of what myths are, and at various points in this sequence I will return to the subject of defining myths, producing various different, but not necessarily mutually exclusive, versions of what they are. Most people, I suppose, who speak English have got some sense that there are certain entities called myths. Myths is one of these words which recurs repeatedly in discussions of human societies in all parts of the world. And what I want to do in this sequence is to begin with an actual example which will take up the whole of the first lecture. On the basis of that example, I'll then go on to look further afield at what myths are and to link myths in different parts of the world. But to start off with, then, I want to say, first of all, that myths represent a narrative of encounters between human beings and the superhuman authorities. This is a quality which runs right through them, and the example that I'm going to use makes that point, among others. A second definition, which I'm going to give you right at the beginning, is that myths are the most important stories that people tell, but I won't qualify that at this stage. What I will do at this stage is to make an observation which is about formal education, about universities, about lecturing, and indeed about the problems of teaching anthropology. For the most part, when people are trying to teach students anthropology, they are relying upon sources which are second-hand, third-hand, or even fourth-hand. What they're doing, of course, is that they are not, for the most part, engaging in encounter. Most university students are not able to actually go out and live with the Nuer, to live with the Iban, or to live with the Tikapia. They are being exposed to accounts that various people have written about these peoples. Very often they're reading textbooks which rely upon these accounts and then at third hand integrate them into general discussions about anthropological theory. At this point in this sequence, there is a slight difference. What you are engaged in today is direct, it's first hand. You are people listening to a myth. I am a storyteller. I am telling you a myth, and this myth is genuine. In other words, at this point in the sequence, we snap out of the second hand, the third hand, and the fourth hand into the directly first hand. In the year 1422, the English king, Henry V, died in the course of his campaigns in France. And he was succeeded on the throne of England by a baby, King Henry VI. In the autumn of the same year, the old mad King of France, Charles VI, also died and was succeeded on the throne of France by the same baby, Henry II of France. Although the young Henry must have been too young at that time to take a great deal of notice of what was going on around him, his older contemporaries could hardly but be struck by the difference between the two kingdoms whose crowns Henry was now expected to wear. On the one hand, England was prosperous Its farming booming, its trade, if anything, even more flourishing. It was a place which had suffered fairly little from destructive warfare in the previous couple of hundred years. By contrast, large areas of France had been much affected by fighting, and indeed there were significant areas, particularly in the northwest of the Kingdom of France, where large areas of land were going out of cultivation, and some villages, it seems, were actually being depopulated as people fled to the shelter of the walled towns. Behind all this was a single fact. In the middle of the 14th century, King Edward III of the Plantagenet royal family of England had laid claim to the crown of France, and since that time, France had been subjected to a series of raids and campaigns by the King of England, who based these partly upon England itself and partly upon the lands which, as a great lord, he held in France. It's not necessary for me to tell you the whole background to this story, but the story is complicated. King Henry V had renewed the Plantagenet claim to the French crown, and the struggle had gone on, and the devastation had resumed. Indeed, it may even have become more severe. France, therefore, was a country which was divided into quite different economic zones at this time, but the northwest in particular had been already visibly devastated by war. There were other complications too. For practical purposes, France as a kingdom had disappeared. Through the feudal period, France had always been essentially a loose assemblage of great lordships, with the King of France presiding over a committee of variously loyal barons. The conflict over the crown had divided the French aristocracy and indeed the French clergy, who had supported different sides in the conflict. And the result of this was that for practical purposes, the Kingdom of France had broken up into four great blocks of territory under four different governmental forms. The largest single block of territory, you can see it on the map here, constituted the centre of the old French kingdom and stretched down continuously to the Mediterranean coast and to the more eastern part of the Pyrenees. This single great chunk was under the control of the factions who were loyal to Charles the Dauphin. A few words about Charles the Dauphin. I'll have to say a bit more about him later because he's a key figure in the story. But Charles had actually been 10 at the time when the deal between many of the great northern barons and the northern clergy and King Henry V had been done way back in 1420. In 1420, there had been two key arrangements. One was that Charles VI's daughter, Catherine, was married to Henry V. And the second was that although Charles himself would stay on the throne for his lifetime, his successor would be the son born of Catherine from her marriage with Henry. In other words, of the two front-runners in the struggle for the French crown, the Plantagenet House of England and the Valois House, who had been pushed forward by certain sections of the French aristocracy as their opponents, and of whom Charles VI was a representative, these two houses were to marry each other, and the joint line resulting would be the new Royal House of France. There was one enormous snag in all this. Charles the Dauphin, 10 at the time of the 1420 agreement, as I've said, was to be totally excluded with all his heirs thenceforward from the succession. There was, of course, another main snag, which you might have guessed, Not everybody in the French aristocracy, not everybody in the French clergy, and probably not everybody in that vast body of people, the silent majority who lived in the villages, actually agreed with the deal. And the malcontents gathered around the young Charles the Dauphin and pushed him forward as the next King of France. The result, of course, was continuing civil war in France. The deal of 1420 didn't clinch anything. Like many things in history designed to solve problems, it actually generated a whole new set. Now, the sequence with which we are concerned may seem very long and complicated, but it is vital in order to understand the story. To the west of those territories loyal to Charles the Dauphin was a strip of territory along the Biscay frontage, centering on the great wine-exporting city of Bordeaux. This area had long been loyal to the Plantagenets, not as kings of France, but as dukes of Guienne, and it remained loyal to the Plantagenets in the context of this civil war. To the north of it, a great block of territory which included Brittany and Normandy was effectively by this stage part of the territories of the King of England as claimant to the Crown of France. Again, I'll cut short the detail. The detail is terribly interesting, but we won't go into it here. Normandy had become the King of England's great fortress in continental Europe, the military pad from which he expected to make himself the King of France. And Brittany could usually be relied upon in this context to go along with the Plantagenets and with the King of England. Out to the east of Brittany and Normandy, and including the old capital, the city of Paris itself, was a vast chunk of northeastern France loyal to the Duke of Burgundy. The Duke of Burgundy was by far the most powerful single godfather in the Kingdom of France. He also had domains outside France in the Holy Roman Empire, to the north and to the east. And the Duke of Burgundy more or less assumed that whoever would be the King of France would need his support. The Duke of Burgundy assumed that his support was the critical factor in the balance between the Valois group of factions and the Plantagenet group of factions, which would swing the future of France. Basically, in the Duke of Burgundy's opinion, nobody would ever become King of France without his support, and in 1420, the Dukes of Burgundy had switched their support from a dubious backing of the Valois to a much more wholehearted backing of the Plantagenets, critical to the deal of that year, 1420. If you look at the map then, what you see is that Charles was in a position where he had an enormous chunk of France loyal to him, but he was fronted to the north and to the west by enemies who were united at this point in a single alliance against him. There was indeed only one gap on the western frontage where Charles was able to gain access to the Atlantic. His access to the Mediterranean was clear. His access to the Mediterranean's western oceanic frontage, of course, was very much less clear. In fact, he only had a small outlet through the territory of La Rochelle, by which he was in contact with the Atlantic. And this is dramatically interesting in terms of the story, because through this narrow La Rochelle gap, year after year, came the reinforcements sent to him by his only truly reliable ally outside the Kingdom of France itself. A character perhaps worth bringing into the story at this time, if only for local interest. King James Stuart of Scotland was determined that the Plantagenets should never become the kings of France, and he was prepared to go to great trouble and great expense to send soldiers every year to the Bay of Biscay to reinforce Charles. Through La Rochelle, year after year, came the reinforcements from Scotland that would keep Charles fighting. There were other international complications, of course, but I won't detail them here. This is a fairly brief version of this particular myth, complicated as it may sound at this stage. Now, the fighting between the two great groups of factions continued right through the 1420s. I've mentioned already that King Henry V died in 1422, and he left an infant son who was the heir to the two crowns. At least, that was according to the 1420 agreement. Charles, of course, and Charles' supporters in the centre and the south did not accept the young baby Henry as the King of France at all. That was the problem. And the fighting went on. In Paris, which was treated as the capital still by the northern faction, the Plantagenets and their Burgundy allies, in Paris, the Duke of Bedford, brother of the late King Henry and uncle of the new King Henry, was regent over a government which claimed to be the government of the whole of France, but of course could not control the centre and the south of the Mediterranean coast. Meanwhile, Charles' own supporters had set up a provisional capital at Bourges, south of the Loire, well back from the fighting front, but close enough to it to be practical. France then had broken up into bits, at least two bits, possibly indeed four bits, or even more. The two alliances were very complicated. The clergy and the secular rulers of the various provinces of France pursued their own ends, backing whom they felt would give them the best return on their investment. In the October of 1428, the Duke of Bedford, acting as regent in Paris and in overall command of the King of England's forces in France, sent a task force south to besiege the great city of Orleans on the north bend of the Loire. You can see it here if you look at the map, which was at the edge of Charles' territories. The citizens of Orleans were, most of them, intensely loyal to Charles and to the Valois house, and when they knew that a northern army was advancing against them, they slammed the city gates in their faces and dug in for a long siege. At some stage, they hoped, Charles and his commanders would send an army northwards to relieve them. But month after month, through the autumn and the winter, the relieving force did not come. In the midst of these great affairs, it is not surprising that nobody took much notice of a minor incident which occurred at this time on the extreme eastern border of the Kingdom of France. France at that time did not extend as far east as it does today, and much of the eastern border lay along the valley of the River Meuse in the western part of the great Duchy of Lorraine. And in the valley of the Meuse stood the castle of Vaucouleurs, which was commanded by Robert de Baudricourt, loyal to the Dauphin, and holding what was effectively an island of the Dauphin's territory, surrounded on some sides by territories held by his enemies, and on others by territories that were neutral. One day, in the May of 1428, before the siege of Orleans had begun, de Baudricourt was told that there were two people at the gate of the castle asking to see him. They said that they had important information. De Baudricourt told the guard to show them in. One of them was a man from a nearby village, the other was a young woman. The man was a kinsman of the young woman's mother. He had come as guardian and guide to Vaucouleurs, but it was the young woman who did most of the talking. She must have been about 16. Actually, she didn't know how old she was, and neither did her parents. There were no birth certificates in the Meuse Valley in the 15th century. She told de Baudricourt that her name was Jeanne. Her father's name was Jacques. They lived in a village called Domremy, a place further up the Meuse Valley from Vaucouleurs. She said that she had very important business with the Dauphin and that she needed de Baudricourt's help to get to the Dauphin's court. For some years now, she said, she had heard voices. And more recently, these voices had begun to tell her that she must take the Dauphin to the cathedral at Reims, where the kings of France are crowned, and there she was to see that he was properly crowned as King of France. The voices had identified themselves as the Archangel Michael and the saints Margaret and Catherine. It's not difficult to appreciate de Baudricourt's reaction to this extraordinary news. He sent them both away and he went about his business. But several months later, in the February of 1429, she was back at the castle asking to see de Baudricourt again. He was not very pleased to see her, but he did agree to talk to her, and he discovered that her story, already fantastic, was becoming even more extraordinary. Her voices had now informed her that she must relieve the besieged city of Orleans. De Baudricourt's position, however, was becoming increasingly embarrassing. Although he himself was no more convinced by the girl on her second visit than he'd been on her first, he discovered that his position was increasingly difficult. He was over a barrel. He could no longer so easily as the first time send her away. Outside the castle, in the town of Vaucouleurs itself, Jeanne had begun to talk to the local townspeople. Many of them listened to her with attentive interest. And inside the castle too, so de Baudricourt now found, some of the soldiers were beginning to take her seriously. Two of them in particular, two young squires from Lorraine, Jean de Metz and Bertrand de Poulengy, who were junior officers in the army and part of de Baudricourt's garrison at the castle. Both of them now began to urge de Baudricourt to give the girl a break. Eventually, he gave in. Jean and Bertrand were to accompany Jeanne across France to the Dauphin's court. They would take with them a small number of soldiers from the Vaucouleurs garrison, and also a herald, a messenger who had recently arrived from Charles as part of his contact with his outlying forces. The people in Vaucouleurs provided Jeanne with a horse for the journey and also with clothes. The clothes were men's clothes for much of the rest of her life. She would dress like a man, and she cut her hair short in the pudding basin hairstyle, which was then fashionable among men, and you can see it on the portraits of Henry V and his brother Bedford and other men of this period. The purpose of this change of appearance at the time was that a solitary woman travelling with soldiers would attract instant attention, and attention was the last thing they wanted. As it was, they travelled much of the time at night to avoid the English and Burgundian patrols. And travelling in this way, they reached the Loire and crossed it and rode on towards the Dauphin's court. They knew from the herald that Charles was currently not at Bourges, his provisional capital, but at the castle of Chinon, lower down the Loire Valley, and it was towards Chinon that they were heading. A generation later, a by then middle-aged Jean de Metz told a court that when he had first met the girl, Jeanne from Domremy, he had intended to seduce her. But he never did, and he never tried. By the time they reached Chinon, he was convinced that she would get Charles, the Dauphin, to that coronation. By now, some of you, perhaps most of you, will know who she is. Myths do not owe their power, the impact that they have on people, to the fact that they have never been told before. Far from it, myths by their nature are told over and over again. This particular story has been told for 5.5 centuries. And who is she? She is La Pucelle, the maid. The soldiers never called her, as far as we know, La Vierge. That would have been open blasphemy. But it is fairly clear that as time went on, they identified her with the Virgin Mary. La Pucelle is not very different from La Vierge. It has broadly the same meaning. And the process by which this girl emerged as a sort of French surrogate for the Virgin Mary is, well, part of the story that I'm telling you. The English usually call her Joan of Arc, and they have good reason to know who she is, because Joan of Arc is the most humiliating single fact in English history. But in that Lent of 1429, there was not a single English soldier besieging Orleans, not a single member of the Regent's Council in Paris who had ever heard of her. They all had a nasty shock coming, and soon. The party of travellers arrived at Chinon and announced their arrival to the Dauphin's provisional court there. Charles himself was informed that they had come and that this girl from Lorraine wanted to see him. Perhaps slightly surprisingly, he agreed instantly to see her and listened, apparently very impressed, in that first long conversation that he had with her in the open court. The girl, I'll call her Joan from this point forward, the girl demanded, however, that she should speak to him at greater length and in private. Her voices had commanded her to tell certain things to Charles which were for his ears only, and nobody else was to hear them. Charles agreed to this private conversation, and in the course of it, as far as we know, she duly told him what her voices had told her to tell him. The information that she received from her voices is a subject about which, not surprisingly, we don't know very much. the inner story of Joan of Arc remains unavoidably unwritten and unwritable. On the one hand, her voices clearly gave her some information which was for public consumption. It was exoteric. The fact that she was to crown the Dauphin, the fact that she was to relieve Orleans, appears to have been open to public knowledge. There was apparently a third category, which consisted of information which she was not to reveal at all to anybody, and the second category, which I've mentioned briefly, namely that which she was to reveal to Charles, but to nobody else. She swore Charles to secrecy. To the best of our knowledge, he kept his promise to her to the day of his death, decades later. Unavoidably, therefore, I can't tell you what went on in that conversation between Charles and Joan at Chinon. But what is clear from what we do know is that Charles emerged from the conversation even more impressed than he had been by his initial impression of her. At this stage, fairly certainly, he had determined, so far as was in his power, to take the girl into his service and to send her up to the relief of Orleans, which of her voices, of course, had told her she must relieve. But Charles, of course, was a feudal ruler. He was not an autocrat who could move at his own discretion. He was surrounded by counselors. He was surrounded by princes of the church. He was, in many ways, the political plaything of a complex of coalition factions which were pushing him forward as the next king of France. He couldn't do exactly what he liked. He had to move cautiously. Even at the age of 19, he was hedged about with a host of difficulties of which he must have been very firmly aware. One very serious set of snags he could not possibly ignore. What the girl had to say to him about the French succession, about his own right to be the King of France, about his own duty to be crowned in the cathedral at Reims, all of this clearly touched him closely, but he realized, of course, that a girl who received information from an archangel and from two of the saints in glory was not directly his business at all. It was the business of the clergy, and before he went any further, he must square the clergy. He therefore asked the Archbishop of Reims, who was in exile with him from his cathedral city, to form a small commission of inquiry and interview Joan at their convenience when they were ready to do so. The commission convened in the town of Poitiers, and Joan rode off to Poitiers to talk to them. The conversations at Poitiers are like the secret conversations between Joan and Charles. We don't know what happened at Poitiers. As far as we know, there is no surviving report. Indeed, the matter may have been so confidential that no report was ever actually written. What we do know is that the commission of inquiry, chaired by Regnault de Chartres, the Archbishop of Reims, gave Charles effectively the green light. Nil obstat. They could find nothing wrong with her. There was no reason why a secular prince like Charles himself should not take the girl into his service if that was what he wanted to do. And Charles was now free to do exactly what he wanted to do. He appointed Joan a captain in his army. Captain was the highest rank in the army under Charles himself as titular commander in chief. In modern terms, he made her a general, and he set her up in a household of her own, suitable for a gentleman of her rank. He set his armourers to work, making her armour. It was, in fact, a special suit of white armour, which was very distinctive. And he placed under her direct command the newly recruited troops earmarked for the relief of Orleans. It was the most decisive thing that Charles ever did, and it was the turning point of his career. He never looked back. When Easter was over, wearing her new armour and commanding her new troops, Joan left for the Loire and for Orleans. The Dauphin's commander at Orleans was his own illegitimate first cousin, Jean. Jean was alleged to be the illegitimate son of the Duke of Orleans, Charles' dead uncle, who had been assassinated in the course of the faction fighting which at this period surrounded the French crown. The Duke had been very popular, however, with the Orleans people themselves, and they accepted Jean as the commander of the garrison with considerable pleasure. Through the autumn and the winter, Jean and his garrison and the citizens had held off the northern besieging army, but with increasing difficulty. They were now completely out of supplies, they were desperately short, and the citizens had put out a feeler to the Duke of Burgundy to accept their surrender. At this point, however, a remarkable turn of events occurred. The Duke of Bedford, hearing of the offer, had flown into one of his uncontrollable rages, a problem which many members of the Plantagenet royal house suffered from, and he had made a number of unpolitical remarks about the Duke of Burgundy, which included statements of the kind that he was not accustomed to beating the bushes so that somebody else could take the birds. The Duke of Burgundy now himself went into a bad mood on hearing this news and decided to withdraw his troops from the siege of Orleans. At the same time, other things were happening too. The Duke of Bedford's commander at Orleans had been the Earl of Salisbury, and the Earl of Salisbury had been looking at the walls of the city from a specially constructed siege tower through one of the narrow arrow slits which were provided in its walls. As he had done so, a bullet fired from the walls of the city had ricocheted in and killed him on the spot. It was a multi-million to one freak shot, but it sent a shudder of apprehension through the besieging army. And as she came up from the south with her troops, Joan was about to show to her own forces a good sign, a set of vibrations as good as the killing of the Earl of Salisbury had been bad. Meanwhile, the Duke of Bedford sent south to replace the dead Salisbury Edward de la Pole, Earl of Suffolk, another English aristocrat in the English expeditionary force in France. Meanwhile, Joan, with her voices and her troops, moved northwards to the riverbank near Orleans. Now, there was a problem about all this. Long before she finally arrived to relieve the city, Jean, the commander of the garrison, had long been working on provisions for what would happen when she did arrive. She brought with her, of course, fresh troops. She brought with her the Scottish reinforcements that had come through La Rochelle and which I mentioned earlier, And she brought with her food, enormous quantities of food, absolutely indispensable if Orleans was to be kept fighting. But of course, allowing the siege to go on indefinitely was only going to prolong the problem of feeding the garrison and the hungry citizens. It's quite clear that Charles and Joan, and by implication Joan's voices, understood that she was to relieve the city finally. This was the big one. She had to force the Northern army to let go. Before that, however, Jean faced his immediate problem. Joan would come up to the south bank, and the city, as you can see from the diagram, was on the north bank. In the course of the fighting, the besiegers had gained control of the bridge over the river into Orleans, and the citizens had firmly shut the south gate so that the besiegers couldn't get in from the bridge. At the same time, however, the besiegers had not managed to gain control of the east gate, and here the garrison had been able to keep it open so that reinforcements and supplies could come in. Now, if Jean was going to bring the reinforcing troops, the Scots and Joan's new recruits, and also the food into the city, he had to be able to ferry them across the river and into the east gate. So what he did was to gather on the north bank near the east gate a motley collection of small craft which could be used for moving troops and supplies. There was a difficulty, however. These were not very subtle watercraft, and they relied upon a favourable wind. And in the weeks through the spring, before Joan's arrival towards the end of April, the wind had blown consistently from the east and from a direction which was, in Jean's terms, very inconvenient for getting the supplies across the river. As Joan brought her troops up to the south bank opposite the east gate, you will have guessed by now, the wind, of course, changed into the most suitable possible position for the moving of the supplies and troops from the south bank into the east gate, and in a very short time, Joan, her troops, the Scots, and the supplies were across the river and inside the city. Joan rested her troops and then took them out onto the next stage of the operation. Now, in order to take the pressure off the city, the first thing that Jean and Joan felt had to be done was to get Suffolk's forces off that bridge and away from the south gate. And so when, after resting her troops, Joan moved them to the south bank again and then along to the bridge, her objective was to force the northern defenders on the bridge to abandon it. At a later point, she told people that with her own hands, she had placed the first of the siege ladders against the bridge on that day, whenever it was, towards the end of April, when their attack began. We don't know the precise date of the beginning of the Battle of Orleans. We do, as I shall say in a moment, know the date that it ended. Indeed, that date is now a public holiday throughout France. The attack on the bridge, however, was no straightforward affair. Not surprisingly, Joan's siege ladder was thrown down instantly by the defenders, and day after day, the attackers' siege ladders were thrown down one after another, and they resumed fighting on the following day and on the following day. The Battle of Orleans is difficult to date precisely, but it went on for about 10 days from late April and into May. On May the 8th, a day which the citizens of Orleans have never forgotten. On May the 8th, Joan led her troops out of the city, through the East Gate, across the river to the south bank, and then up to the bridge, as she had done day after day for some days now. But May the 8th was the day that they finally broke through. They captured the bridge, they captured the two small towers, Les Tourelles, which guarded the bridge at the landward end, and they forced Suffolk's northern soldiers totally away from the south gate of the city. Suffolk reconsidered his position, decided that the siege was now hopeless, and before nightfall moved his troops away from the city. Joan's voices had told her that she must relieve Orleans, and she had. She now prepared for the next stage of her journey. Remember, of course, that relieving Orleans was only a prelude to most of what she had to do. She had to get Charles to that coronation in the cathedral at Reims. And she had to persuade not only Charles' commanders, not only Charles' soldiers, but Charles' council members with their own vested interests in the coalition of factions to go ahead with this move. In order to do it, they had to move across an area of the northeast of France to the east of Paris, into territory which was entirely occupied by their enemies, by the King of England's forces, by the Burgundians, and by people who formed part of the alliance against Charles. In order to do this, they would have to leave their bases in the Loire Valley and move into territory which was hostile, while at the same time abandoning their connecting links back to their bases. It's a military operation which has been repeated many times in different places, but it is risky. Eventually, however, the cautious counselors on Charles' council gave in. At one stage in the proceedings, as Charles and his counselors were meeting, the door burst open, and there, framed in the doorway, was Joan. She ran into the room, she knelt at the Dauphin's feet, and she said, well, 15th century French in a Lorraine accent, I won't attempt it. What she said, the gist of what she says was, my Lord Dauphin, we're going to Reims. And in the end, they went to Reims. But by this time, there were new developments in the story anyway. In Paris, the Duke of Bedford registered that his southern front was beginning to crumble. The Earl of Suffolk, having abandoned the siege of Orleans, now moved his troops downstream towards the Atlantic, and as he did so, Charles' captains, commanding various sections of his army, moved in behind him and forced him further and further downstream. In this increasingly dangerous situation, Bedford whistled up a special task force and sent them south under their commander, Sir John Falstaff. Sir John Falstaff, who here makes a special guest appearance in the story, a guest appearance which was to be brief and ignominious. Bedford was sending Falstaff south to shattering disaster. But Falstaff did succeed in linking his mercenary freelance units up with the Lord Talbot, the second commander that Bedford was sending south, and together the two battle units headed for the Loire Valley. As they did so, Charles' commanders, Joan among them, registered that these reinforcements were moving south and moved into position to intercept them near the village of Patay, where the country is covered with hedges and with small woods. It's the kind of country which in French, in modern French, is called bocage. It was therefore very difficult for the two sides to see each other, and as far as we can tell, the northern intelligence was absolutely dreadful. They didn't, in fact, succeed at all well in realizing the danger that they were in, and Charles' captains, with Joan, with the Scots, came in on their tail through the hedges. As they did so, a stag, which was hiding up in one of the woods, startled by the advancing army of Charles' soldiers, was startled to break cover, and as it galloped away through the hedgy country, it landed in the middle of the northern troops as they headed along in column of route, and the shout that went up from the northern troops immediately alerted Joan and the other captains to the position of the enemy, and they closed in. The Battle of Patay was brief. Falstaff ran. Talbot desperately attempted to hold a position between the hedges and was overwhelmed. It's always very dangerous to look at casualty figures because we all know that they're used as propaganda by rival sides, but the casualty figures, which are part of the story of the Battle of Patay, are startling by any standards. A Burgundian mercenary who was fighting in the northern forces at the time reckoned that their side lost 2,000 dead at Patay. That may not sound very many to people in 20th century Europe who are hardened by the battles of Passchendaele and of Stalingrad, but for the professional soldiers of 15th century Western Europe, 2,000 dead in a single battle was Holocaust. More startling still, however, are the figures for the Dauphin's soldiers. 3. In a battle where the North lost 2,000 dead, Joan's side lost 3. As the story of the girl who heard voices becomes increasingly uncanny, Joan herself, of course, was quite unmoved by the sorts of awe which were by now affecting Charles' soldiers. Her main objective at this point was to take advantage of the stunning victory at Patay and drive through to Reims at the earliest possible opportunity. And so they set off. With the last objections of the most stubborn councillors removed, they were free to go. The army collected Charles, and with him they set off along the road towards Reims. They reached the town of Auxerre, and the citizens opened their gates. They reached the town of Troyes, and the citizens opened their gates. And they marched on into the Champagne country and to Reims. And in Reims, the citizens opened their gates and let them in. On July the 17th, in the cathedral, Joan, wearing a surcoat of cloth of gold, stood beside Charles through the whole of the ceremony, in which Arunio de Chartres, the archbishop, now returned from exile with the army to his own cathedral, anointed and crowned Charles, King of France. There were now two kings of France, but only one of them had been crowned in the cathedral according to the due ceremony. At this point, the soldiers loyal to Charles were in a peculiar position. They'd advanced very far northwards, but they had left behind them their secure bases, and it was not clear what they should do next. Joan's voices don't seem to have had a clear way ahead for them. Indeed, Joan had now done everything that her voices had told her to do. And from this point forward, she seems to have had to decide what to do in terms of normal, mundane human judgment. She and the other captains decided to push straight westwards to Paris and to see if they could get into the city. It was very difficult, as you probably realise from the story of Orleans, to get into one of these feudal walled cities. And the usual way in which a lot of sieges ended was for a faction within the city to open one of the gates and let the besieging army in. And it may well be, of course, that at this stage Joan hoped that this would happen. But the citizens of Orleans, most of them loyal to the Duke of Burgundy, didn't, on this occasion, open their gates. Joan herself was wounded by a crossbow bolt through the thigh, and the army eventually pulled off southwards, back to the base along the Loire. It's not necessary for me to tell you the whole of the detail of this story. What I want to do is to highlight, in a shortened version of it, features which are of resounding mythical interest. In the course of the fighting, which went on, Joan herself, during a skirmish outside the town of Compiègne, was pulled from her horse by a Burgundian mercenary and eventually found herself a prisoner in the hands of the Duke of Burgundy himself. The Duke of Burgundy was in an enviable position. He held the balance of power between the two sides, and he now had in his hands the most desirable prisoner of war in the whole of Europe. None of us know now, of course, what went through the Duke of Burgundy's imagination in those weeks when he held Joan as a prisoner, but we do know what he did. He accepted a very lucrative offer from the Duke of Bedford, and he handed Joan over to her much more serious enemies than the Duke of Burgundy himself, who was in many ways sitting on the fence. And Bedford had her transferred to the heart of Normandy, to the heart of France, which was held by the King of England's armies. Bedford was in an increasingly desperate position, and although we do not know the scheming and the planning that lies behind this part of the story, the outcome of it was that Joan was tried by a church court in Rouen in the province of Normandy. One of the clergy loyal to the Plantagenets, Pierre Couchon, the Bishop of Beauvais — he is now, incidentally, by far the most hated man in the history of France — Pierre Couchon presided over a church court in which Joan was tried. It's a fascinating story. The entire transcript of the trial still survives, apparently word for word, accurately, as it occurred. And by a series of moves, Couchon appears to have tricked Joan. I want to be careful about this, because this is a very contentious story, and I don't want to be too partisan, even about the bastards who burnt Joan of Arc. But adopting a position of strict neutrality, of course, the outcome of Joan's trial was that on a highly technical charge, she was found guilty of lapse into heresy. And lapse into heresy was one of those convictions which allowed a church court to hand the convicted prisoner over to the secular arm with the habitual plea for mercy, of course. but with the understanding that they were then liable to capital punishment, and particularly they were liable to be burnt at the stake. Now, in this case, the secular arm was the provincial government of Normandy under the authority of the Duke of Bedford's government in Paris. And it seems highly likely, as French schoolchildren are now told, that the whole trial anyway was a set-up between Bedford and the Bishop of Beauvais, which was designed deliberately to discredit Joan by having her burnt on a serious metaphysical charge, a church charge, not a secular charge. I won't go into this week. It's something I can mention a little more in detail next week when I look at the story. But again, the outcome of the story is that on the 30th of May, 1431, in the old market square at Rouen, Joan was burnt at the stake in the presence of a huge crowd, many of whom were clearly in a very ugly mood, and whom Bedford's soldiers had some difficulty restraining. It's not really the end of the story. The story goes on and on. Very briefly, the fighting went on through the rest of the 30s, through the whole of the 40s, and into the 50s, and the King of England's forces were almost entirely driven out of France by the autumn of 1453. I'll tell you a bit more about the sequel to this story next week. But before I end this week, and remember this is a very shortened version of the story, it can be told over a period of months if you are determined to do that. Before I end this week, there is one observation which I must make, because as I have been talking to you, you have been saying to yourselves, surely this is an extraordinary story to tell as an example of a myth, because all these events you have been telling us about today did actually happen. Every single one of them is real. And the people in this story are real people. They're not fictional characters. They are people you can read about in the history books of France. Now, that takes me right into the middle of the problem that I want to talk about in the next lecture. But in the very, very crudest sense, in the simplest possible terms, yes, you are absolutely right. The story that I have been telling you today is based upon events which did all of them occur, and the people in this story are as real as we are. But this story, and this is the basis of what I need to say next week, this story is a myth. It is indeed the mythical charter of the modern French state and of modern French identity, and it is the mythical charter of modern France, because every government of France since 1429 owe their legitimacy to Joan of Arc, and if Joan of Arc was not right, then the current president of France does not have any claim whatever to his office. But as every French schoolboy will tell you, of course, Joan wasn't wrong. She was absolutely right, and the whole edifice of modern French history and constitution and government that is built upon her is quite rightly built upon her. Myths are very often used as the foundation of the action of the people who tell them, and this is a fine example of precisely that other aspect, that and other aspects of myths. And I will go on to tell you why this is such a good example of a myth in the next lecture.